Hi, this is Helen Stubbs for Galactic Chat, talking to Brisbane author Talitha Calligo. How are you, Talitha?
I'm great.
So we're talking about your new book, Lifesphere Inc. In Lifesphere Inc., the main character is Ellie, who's 13. He spends his time scavenging on the rim, selling trash to survive. On the top side, citizens live in luxury. A grifter named Calix offers Ellie a trade, a mika of his own, if he competes in an illegal fight to the death. So tell us what a mika is.
Well, mika come from an egg. Their handler's DNA is introduced before the embryo forms. And
so there's a bond there.
Yeah, and then the DNA causes the egg to develop and grow and hatch. And so then when the mika hatches, it's bonded to its handler. And they're actually a synthetic creature. They're developed in a lab. And they have a human-level intelligence. They can talk to their handlers and they can talk to other mika. And handlers can only have one mika ever because of this symbiotic relationship between them. So they usually, if something happens to the mika or something happens to the handler, the other doesn't survive.
And they're usually pretty big, aren't they, too?
They can vary quite a bit. You can get very small mika and you can get very large mika. It sort of depends. There's a lot of variation.
And not everyone can have a mika either, can they? Are they prohibitively expensive for a lot of people, or there are laws about who can have them?
Yeah, at the start of the book, anyone who can afford one can buy one, but then they pass a law that means that if people don't have citizenship, then they're not allowed to purchase mika or own them.
And it's like and they don't have citizenship, do they?
Because yes, there's a large portion of the population who live outside the city who are living in poverty, and they don't have citizenship, so it would prohibit people who are living in poverty from obtaining mika of their own.
So it's really having a mika is Ellie's chance to sort of move up into the city, isn't it, to a better life.
Yeah, the mika handlers, they have competitions, and there's lots of different ways the mika can compete. They can race or they can have battles in arenas. And the mika who win a lot are famous. They're on TV. They're like celebrities now, like sports stars. So Eli hopes that if he can get a mika of his own, then he'll become famous and he'll become rich as well, and he'll be able to escape the poverty that he's grown up in.
So Lifesphere feels to me like it could be a city on Earth in the future. Is that what you see it as? Or
absolutely, yeah. It's future Earth where, you know, people haven't looked after the world and now it's dead. There's no wild animals and there's no forests. The entire land areas of the world is a desert. And the media is really good at manipulating people and lying to people so that they are kept in the dark about the things that matter. So no one in the city knows who controls the city, who the government is. And they don't know what happens to criminals either. There's not a very fair justice system. So if you're arrested, no one knows what happens to you. You just vanish.
So the main characters, Eli and Squall, are they inspired by anyone that you know?
No, a lot of authors experience this thing where the characters just seem to come out of nowhere, they just come out of the ether, and my characters are very much like that. They develop organically, they're not based on real people. However, every character that I write, even the bad guys, has a little something in them that's me. And often it may not even be in the book, you know, maybe the bad guy and I have the same favourite food or something like that, because I need to be able to see the world from their perspective. And it doesn't matter how horrible they are, I have to be able to empathise with them. I think it's really important with bad guys that you can do that, to understand their motives and believe them, even if you don't agree with what they're doing. The very best bad guys are the ones that think they're good guys. They don't think they have any option, or they think they're doing what's in the best interest of their victims. I think villains like that are really scary because they're realistic.
So do you have some sympathy for Caleb?
I do, even though he's a very terrible person. I do feel sorry for him because he's quite pathetic.
So, now, you mentioned that you have a disability. How does that affect your writing?
Lots of ways, all the time. It makes things really difficult for me that are quite easy for other people, which is really frustrating. And I have a lot of drive and passion, and some people find that a bit intimidating, I think, because I can be really full on. But if I wasn't, I'd never get anything done. I'm in constant pain. I'm in so much pain that I've broken bones and not known, because we can only really feel one pain at a time. So if you have a worse pain, then you won't know you've got other littler pains. So I'm in so much pain that broken bones were less painful.
Where is your pain?
I have organ failure, so I get a lot of pain around my liver, and I get really bad migraines. So it's really hard to function like that, because when you're in pain all the time, you're really tired, and I get really cranky, to be honest, because when you're in pain all the time, it's really frustrating. So some days it's really hard to focus and write, particularly if I've got a really bad migraine.
Does writing help you push through the pain?
I really love writing. There's nothing I enjoy more than writing, so you know, if I'm writing, then I'm having a great time. On the days when I can't write, it can be, you know, upsetting, because I want to write and I can't, and I don't have that, the best thing I could do, the most fun thing that I could do, I can't do it because I'm too sick.
Do you have any advice for writers who want to put characters with disabilities in their stories?
Know what you're talking about. Don't ever guess. If you don't have a disability, and hopefully most people who are writing don't, then you need to, and you want to write about some specific disability, you need to talk to people who do, even if you talk to them online and read their blogs, and but it's best if you can spend time with them and learn how they do day-to-day things, because there's a lot of things that we can just do, or other people can just do, that you don't realise are a problem for people with disabilities. For example, when I have a migraine, I always get tunnel vision, and I walk into doors and walls all the time, and I end up with all these bruises, and it looks like I'm being horribly abused by someone. I'm not. I'm just literally walking into doors. But if you're writing someone in a wheelchair, you have to think about how they get dressed, how they go to the bathroom, how they manoeuvre around furniture in their house, how they get things out of high cupboards. It's really, really tricky when you can't use your legs, particularly if they're a dead weight and, you know, you've got to lift them and move them to do stuff, which is obviously something I had to consider when I was writing Squall. And, you know, it's the same if you're writing someone who's blind or someone who's deaf or someone who's only got one arm or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing, you have to familiarise yourself with the everyday problems they have, because people who have those disabilities will read your book and they'll be disappointed if they're misrepresented.
And I guess fiction's a great opportunity for people to share experiences. Like, as you said, a lot of people don't realise how challenging life can be or where the problems are for people with disabilities, so maybe fiction is an in for those people without disabilities.
And hopefully seeing that, just empathising with people who have disabilities and seeing that they, you know, have the same hopes and the same dreams, and they're just as intelligent and fun and capable as people who don't have disabilities. And because a lot of people, particularly people in wheelchairs, are treated as if they're not very smart because they're in a wheelchair, which is obviously ridiculous because your legs don't have a lot of impact on your brain.
Next question. If you had a Mika, what would it look like?
I have a Mika. Absolutely. His name is Topher. I have three cats and two dogs, but Topher is very special. He was feral when he was found with his brothers and sisters, and he was very difficult to handle even though he was very little. And it took a long time for him and I to learn to trust each other, because he bit and he growled and he was very aggressive. He was very small, but he was very aggressive. But now we're very, very close, and he won't listen to anyone else but me. And he's very upset that he's not allowed in the study this morning because I'm doing this interview, actually. He's a bit sad, but he's a big black mongrel dog with a little white jag on his chest, and he's got these ridiculously large ears that sit up, their big triangles on the top of his head, and they take up the whole top of his head, and these ridiculously long legs. People are always coming up to me and saying how handsome he is, but I think he looks ridiculous. He's very silly, but he's definitely my Mika.
Okay. So what if a kid wants to design their own Mika after they've read your book? What do they do? How do they go about it?
There's no limit. If you're designing your own Mika, it can be like any animal, it can be any colour, it can be any size, you can have horns and wings and tails. A purple raptor is a perfectly legitimate Mika.
So go wild.
Yeah, a flying cat or, you know, whatever it is that you want as your Mika, you can have it.
Awesome. And how long did you work on Lysphere Ink for?
Lysphere Ink was a long process, actually. I started writing it or planning for it in 2006, and I wrote it in 2007 and 2008. And then I actually signed it with an agent, a New York literary agent.
Yeah.
And she shopped it around, she couldn't sell it, and ultimately we parted ways and I put it in a drawer for a long time, and occasionally I'd get it out and I'd do another edit and I'd try and sell it again, and it just wasn't going anywhere. I had lots of people who said they really liked it, but they didn't think they could sell it in the current market. So, you know, it took years to get from concept to actually be out in the world. But actually writing books, particularly the first draft, doesn't take me very long. So I'm usually doing about 10,000 words a week. So if you're talking about a Lysphere novel, that's 5 weeks to get from 0 words to a finished first draft. But then editing takes me forever. I edit it 3 times myself before I get feedback from my beta readers, who are fantastic, and then I'll edit it at least twice more, and often it will then go to another beta reader again, and then go to another edit. So just hundreds of edits before it's ready to be made into a book.
So where are you at with the second book?
The first draft is finished on the second book, and I'm madly editing, doing the first round of edits, and so I'm hoping that in a month or two, it'll be going to all my beta readers again. Yeah, so it's a lot of fun, actually, because I originally wrote the second draft in 2010, and when I read it again, I didn't remember what happened. So it was like reading something that someone else had written.
But I'm sure you really liked it, because
I was... I was surprised. I have to say, there were scenes where I'm like, I can't remember what happens. Oh my god,
it's
so horrible to my characters.
Oh well. So is there a third? Is there
Absolutely.
A novel out there too?
The first 6 books are planned, and as long as the download targets are reached, the first 6 books will definitely be released. They're all, the synopses are all ready, and I'm really excited about writing them. Yeah, so there's definitely 6 books, and if it's doing really well, then there will be more books.
Because you have had books published through the mainstream publishing industry too, haven't you? But this one you decided to go indie publishing. What influenced you in that decision?
Well, a lot of it was when you're working with publishers, there's a lot of things that you don't have any control over. And depending on the publisher, you know, the less control you have. You don't get much of a say in what the title is. You can make suggestions, but they're just as likely to ignore you.
Yeah.
You don't have any say in the colour at all.
And the colour is great, the Lysphere.
I actually did that art myself. It took me 60 hours. I wanted to kill myself. It was it was the biggest artwork I've ever attempted. It was really horrific. And now I've got to do one for book two as well, so... another 60 hours down the drain. But yeah, so in publishing, you don't have control over those things, which maybe for some people is better, because some people have really terrible design skills.
Yeah.
But you also don't have a lot of control over-marketing. There's some things they sort of want you to do, but if you want to do something that's a bit off the wall with marketing, you can't. You're not, you know, you're under their contract. And I even know authors who have, when their books have been published, they've found out that the publisher has changed all their characters' names and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they have control over stuff like that as
that's
well.
That's not cool, is it?
Well, hopefully you have a relationship with your publisher where they're telling you things like that. I've never had it happen to me.
Yeah.
I've worked with Harlequin and they've been really good. But I really wanted to test a marketing idea that I had. And I wanted to do my own covers, and I wanted to have that control. It wasn't something I did because I couldn't get published any other way. I did it because I really wanted to, and I really wanted to have the experience of publishing myself, and I wanted to experiment and test things on my own without a publisher being angry at me.
Are you enjoying the process?
I really am, actually. It's a lot more fun than I thought it would be. I know a lot of people who self-publish and they found it very stressful. I don't know if it's because I've worked with publishers and I've had quite a bit of experience in publishing, but doing it myself was a lot of fun.
So what is the schedule for the releases of the next books?
So this is where my marketing plan that I wanted to test comes in. The first book, book one, is free, and it will always be free. As much as I can make the retailers make it free, occasionally I have to do a bit of a war of the minds with Amazon because they want to put it back up to 99 cents. But as much as possible, it's going to be free forever. And then the rest of the books come out when the first book reaches certain download thresholds.
Yeah.
So when the first book is downloaded 20,000 times, book two will be released. And I was a bit worried, actually. Book one is being downloaded faster than I thought it would be, and I'm a bit worried that I won't have book two ready in time. But then book three will be released when book one has been downloaded 40,000 times, or when 6 months has passed, whichever comes second, so that I have that six-month buffer. And particularly as the downloads just get faster and faster.
That's fantastic. So word's spreading.
Yeah. So, you know, it's... people who enjoy the book, it's in their best interest to really promote it and share it with people.
Yeah.
But they don't ever have to ask people to buy anything because book one will always be free and it only book one downloads count.
Yeah.
So they don't have to be saying, you know, it's not book two that will actually have a cost. It's only book one.
And where else is it available? Amazon and...
I actually found that it was available in another store this morning. I didn't know it was available in, which was kind of a surprise. So at the moment it's available on Smashwords, Amazon, Kobo, Diesel, iTunes, and Barnes & Noble.
Great. And anyone can just go and get it for free. So.
Yeah, you can download it for free. And I didn't actually know it was in Barnes & Noble, and I found it there this morning, and I was surprised. So
how does that
work? Because Smashwords distribute to a lot of different places, it was slowly coming out different places, so this was the first time I've seen it in Barnes & Noble, so that was actually kind of exciting.
I hear that plans for a game are in the pipeline. Where are they at?
They're in very early stages. It's all planned out, but obviously if you're doing a game, you need, you know, developers and graphic artists and web designers and coders and a lot of things that I can't afford at the moment. But when I can afford them, it will be going ahead, and I'm very excited about that as well. You'll be able to design a character and their Mika and play in the world. It will be a text-based largely RPG, like a forum RPG, but there'll be stats and you'll have character housing and there'll be games that you can play, like flash games to gain experience, and there'll be an in-game currency, and you'll be able to buy clothes and things for your avatar and armor for your Mika and all sorts of really fun things. It should be a lot of fun.
Do you have any idea when?
Yeah, the actual Lifesphere website is in development at the moment and should be launching early next year. And then hopefully we'll be able to be getting game development after that. So potentially 2015.
Are there any serious messages behind your book?
There's sort of two main focuses. And yes, absolutely animal cruelty, because I really want the readers to realise that their own pets have feelings too, and they can be sad and scared and lonely and disappointed. And they're your pet and you're responsible for them. They don't have anyone else to look after them. They can't look after themselves. So it's really important that, you know, you put their needs first. And then, of course, there's a lot of messages about inequality in society, and that there's lots of people in the world who are really going without, and there's a lot of people in the world who have a lot more than they need. And we need to be aware of that and aware that there's a lot of people who don't have all the great stuff that we have, like running water and food, let alone all the fun stuff like PlayStations and Xboxes. And so, you know, just keep your fellow man in mind. Or woman. Fellow people.
Well, thanks for talking to me today. They're all my questions. Do you have anything else that you want to add?
The message that I'd like to leave everyone with is word of mouth is really important to authors. So if you like a book, whether it be mine or someone else's, it's really important you tell someone, because that's how books become bestsellers. It's not marketing done by publishers or advertisements or anything like that. It's really about people telling other people that they like stuff, and the reader has all the power when it comes to making a book popular. So, whoever your favourite author is, make sure you tell people that they're fantastic.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Talitha.
Thank you for having me. It's been fantastic.